Do you have repair projects that you've been putting off, whether it's basement waterproofing, concrete raising, structural repairs, or attic insulation? PermaSeal provides quality work and free inspections. Don't wait. Call PermaSeal 800-421-7325 or permaseal.net.
And welcome back to Paulistic Behind the Curtain. Shifting gears a little bit from the lyric opera to a really cool book that has recently come out. It's an art book. It's a coffee table book. And it focuses in on Chicago's Fine Arts Building, which is the home of the Studebaker Theater. Perhaps you have been there for various performances. So when this came out, I got very excited about it. And I wanted to talk to the people that are making it happen. And so joining us, the author of the book, Keir Graf. And by the way, Keir, when I read your biography, I mean, you've written like 14 novels and all sorts of anthologies, and you work with your wife and all this kind of stuff. But what I really love is that it notes that you do your very best work from your office where you are now. You are in the Fine Arts Building. That's where you work.
That's right. This is the source of a lot of inspiration for me, and really my happy writing place.
I love it. Jacob Harvey also joins us. He's the managing artistic director of the Fine Arts Building and the Studebaker Theater. I'm guessing you're in your office too, Jacob, though we would never know it.
That's right. I'm coming to you live from the Studebaker Theater.
Okay, I love it. So Keir, the book itself is this story, and I've read the book. I've taken all sorts of notes from it. Just such amazing stories that go on there. But what intrigued you to write the story about this book about this building that got dedicated back in 1898, although it opened its doors in 1895, and it's still here.
1885. Yes. The idea to write the book actually wasn't mine. It was an assignment from the publisher of New City. Brian Higgelke asked me if I would be willing to write an article about the building. He said he'd long been a fan, and I enthusiastically agreed, especially when he said that I could write it long. I said, how long? And he said, long. And I, having been a journalist in a previous life, I thought maybe 5,000 words would be long. It turned out that 25,000 words was the final length of the article. It took up an entire issue of New City. And he inspired me to really dig deep by asking me to really personalize it in a way. He was talking about the work of famous New Yorker writer who did these kind of amazing kind of shoe leather reporting stories way back in the 1930s. And so I kind of put myself in an old fashioned mindset, and which is perfect because it's an old fashioned building. And I just went with it. And then of course, once the article came out, I thought, well, it's in a magazine, and in a couple of months, people may stop reading it. So let's turn it into a book. And I was very fortunate to be connected to Trope Publishing, a Chicago-based publisher that primarily does gorgeous photography books, and they were so excited, and they're the reason the book is so beautiful.
And it is, as I said, I introduced it as a coffee table book because the artwork is so intriguing, but you want to read the story. Jacob, you sort of saw the Fine Arts Building as it went through its historic renovation and all of that. You know, I know along the doorway, and there's a picture of it in the book early on, and the building is at 410 South Michigan. It says, all passes, art alone endures. That's a very encouraging phrase, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think very aptly and hysterically worded in the foreword of the book by Gillian Flynn, saying, you see those doors and it makes you want to stop Googling cats and get to work. You know, it's a real serious place where serious work is going on. But, you know, I take that really to heart, because as you know, from all the conversations we have had over the last couple of years with the renovation of the Studebaker and sort of the revitalization of this building coming out of the pandemic, is a lot of the work we've been doing is really understanding the past and really investing in the past and telling the stories of the past so that we can start writing the chapters of the future. And Keir's book has really memorialized that in a really kind of beautiful way. The photography is outstanding, but like you said, the stories of the building are really, I think, what sings through of the book, because there's so many incredible little nuggets throughout history.
And again, the building, the sconces and the iron framing on the front doors. I mean, this is the building that brings the past and it lives today. And fortunately in the renovation, because by the way, Keir, as you tell the whole story of this building from beginning to today, there were times it was thought this building was going to get shut down and yes, sold maybe to a developer, and maybe torn down. I don't know.
In the early 1970s, the Chicago Tribune reported that there was real concern that it would be sold to a developer because the land underneath it was more valuable than the building. When the building was sold by the Studebaker Corporation, the Studebaker brothers, to a corporation they had created, and I think it was like 1915, it was then the single largest real estate transaction in the city of Chicago. And I think the price was $3 million or something, and it wouldn't be sold for that much again, you know, I mean, like ever. Like, it just, the value just kept declining year after year because it's such a magnificent building and it's so hard to keep it up. And of course, the wonderful thing about publishing this book now is that the building is undergoing a renaissance under the ownership of Erica Berger. It is being restored to its former glory. It is full again. It is singing again. And it's the most exciting time to be not just writing about it, but to be a tenant here.
And by the way, the fact that Keir is a tenant, what people need to know, Jacob, a lot of people just, they know it is the Studebaker Theater at this point, right? We go to see Liz Callaway. We go to see these great shows that are there. Can you just give us, I know you are also a master of the history of this, Jacob, speaking of the Studebaker itself, Lunton Fontaine, can you just give us some of the people who have performed on that stage through the centuries?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, Yul Brynner, Eartha Kitt, a very young Martin Sheen, famously one of many of Sarah Bernhardt's farewell tours happened here. And the funny joke there is that, you know, theaters were loath to program Sarah Bernhardt because no one would go see shows anywhere else. And she would only sell tickets at whatever theater she was at, and all the other theaters would shut down when she was in town. So yeah, there's just this amazing plethora of not just performers and actors, but theater companies and stories that come from the Studebaker Theater. I think my favorite one that I think is also the most significant to Chicago is a very short-lived story from 1955 to, I think, 1957. Bernie Solins co-founded a theater company here called the Studebaker Theater Company, and it only lasted for 2 years. And that flop of a company then springboarded him into co-founding the Second City. And I really love that story as also a story of, you know, you just keep going, you keep chasing that dream, you keep following the path, and failure springboard to success, a door closes, another one opens. And to know that even some of that legacy of the Studebaker Theater emanates to other parts of Chicago, I think is really significant.
By the way, what's significant too was Eartha Kitt's show was Owl and the Pussycat. Not what I would have put her in, but there you go. That's what she was doing. But also, by the way, because I made a little Rex Harrison, Claudette Colbert, Henry mm-hmm. Fonda, Time of Your mm-hmm. Life. Just unbelievable. But Keir, throughout the history in a nutshell, this thing is, it was even an adult movie theater for a period of its time in the 70s.
Very briefly, yes.
Yeah.
The theater... they've tried a lot of things over the years. I mean, the Studebaker, you know, I think they originally intended it to be a recital hall, and then it wasn't working so well. So then they tried to launch, you know, legitimate theater there. And, you know, they've at different times it's been a movie theater. Of course, you know, many people will remember, I mean, when I moved to Chicago in the 90s, you know, it was a fourplex. They had divided the two theaters on the first floor into four different screens.
And the layout it was owned by M&R. I used to work for M&R. I was a theater manager for M&R. So it was, yeah, I remember that period of time. I worked up in Skokie, but yes, I knew those theaters well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just, you know, creative reuse is one, you know, whether it's the material we're creating as artists or whether it's the buildings in which we do our art, it's kind of how we survive and adapt over the years. And, you know, I think that, you know, in some cases, maybe the adult movies were, you know, that's maybe kind of a low light, but a very brief footnote in the history of this building. But, you know, whatever it was, it allowed it to stay alive until this chapter.
But there are also clubs, right? And restaurant. I mean, it was sort of everything. And today, Jacob, it's become this plethora of people where people like here can work there. I mean, there's people working, mm-hmm. there's people performing downstairs. That was always the vision.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and I think it's captured well in Keir's book. You know, the Fine Arts Building is landmarked. It is a historic landmark for the city of Chicago. That's really a consideration of the architecture. The mission of the Fine Arts Building remains the same because owner after owner, that mission has stayed true.
Here, I initially thought you were the photographer of this book. Sorry, you're not, but you write the story that pulls it all together and tells us all the way through. So let's pick up on this. You, by the way, are located. I can tell from your door. You're on the 8th floor of the Fine Arts Building with your office. When you started writing this book, were you in the Fine Arts Building, or did you say, "I'll write the book if you give me an office on the 8th floor"?
I was already in the Fine Arts Building, and that's how it all came about. And I just have to give a shout out to the photographer of the book, Tom Mayday, who's the principal photographer. There are many other photographers' work represented in the book, but he did the principal photography, and he and Trope Publishing are why the book looks so good. Yeah, the reason I got the assignment was by virtue of the fact that I have a studio in the building. I have a studio in the building because my friends who run the second floor bookstore, Exile in Bookville, just a marvelous bookstore, kept encouraging me to get a studio here. And I thought, well, why do I need a studio? I can write from anywhere. But the more time I spent in the building, the more it became abundantly clear to me that I did need a studio in the building because I just wanted to hang out around all these fascinating people who work here. And
And how do you get to,
so,
by the way, do you take the stairs up to your office? Do you take one of the human-operated elevators that I used to have when I practiced law a million years ago?
I almost always take the human-operated elevator. I enjoy the morning conversations with the operators. I try to walk the stairs once a day just for a little exercise.
I love it. You mentioned earlier, Keir, about the Studebaker brothers, but Jacob, I'm going to come to you with this because when we talked a long time ago during the renovation, a lot of people may not know what that building originally was. It was about the Studebaker brothers, and it sure wasn't a fine arts building.
No, that's right. It was originally the Studebaker carriage repository and showroom. So they manufactured or in an assembly line built their horse carriages, and where the Studebaker Theater is right now was the showroom for the horse carriages. I'm told by the Studebaker Museum in South Bend that Lincoln's carriage was likely on display on the windows here in Michigan Avenue. And it was in the 1890s that the Studebaker brothers outgrew this building. And the way I like to tell the story is Charles Curtis, a former mayor's son, convinced the Studebaker brothers that at the turn of the century, there was money to be made in the arts, and they would be well served by transforming this building into an arts building. So they took what was then an 8-story building, they chopped off the 8th floor, and they added a new 8th, 9th, and 10th floor, and then was born the Fine Arts Building.
And Kier, wasn't there something that you mentioned Charles Curtis, and he managed that building for a long time, and something magical, he had some brilliant ideas of doing things around 1928. I think he died in 1928. Interesting timing in terms of an economic crash that the country was going through at the time.
And that really marked the period of a kind of a long, slow decline for the building. In some ways, you know, the heyday, the true golden age of the Fine Arts Building was relatively brief. I mean, from the moment it opened, it became Chicago's premier destination for artists and music instructors, and people flocked to this building. The 10th floor was called by a New York newspaper Chicago's Parnassus because so many luminaries, had studios on the 10th floor. But even kind of by the teens, some of the more kind of edgy and creative artists were starting to decamp for other places. There are trends in any time. And Curtis's death certainly didn't help things because I think he had been so key in recruiting people to the building. And then, of course, yes, the crash of 1929. Artists need patrons, and when people have less money to spend on the arts and to support the arts struggle.
Kier, let me stay with you for the history of this. Talk about Chicago Samuel Insull, who was really critical here as well. I think he gets referred to in the book as sort of our own Citizen Kane. How
Well,
does he play in?
yes. Yeah. Well, he was
Did he
not,
bring a sled to the thing? I don't know.
Yeah, so there's a famous part of the movie Citizen Kane that really you could say has its origins on the stage of the Studebaker. So yeah, Charles Insull was in the early part of the 20th century, Chicago's richest man. He was a utilities magnate. You know, he owned ComEd and People's Gas, and he had married a much younger woman, and she gave up her. She was an actress when they met, and she gave up her career for him. And People around them said that she never stopped reminding him that she had done so. And after they had raised their kids, she decided she wanted to return to the stage in her 50s, but she wanted to play ingenues, which the press at the time was pretty merciless. And they seized on that as being a very comical miscasting. Now, her first performances as an ingenue on the stage of the Studebaker were well received because they were charity balls, and they were to raise money for Children's Hospital, and so everybody was on board and like, this is great. And then, but she was so encouraged by the rapturous applause that she took the show to New York, where everybody was like, yeah, right, you know, go back to Chicago. So reviews were unkind. Joseph Mankiewicz was a theater critic at the time. He saw her perform, thought she was wretched. Legend has it that he was inebriated and didn't finish his Savage review, but he never forgot this moment. And then years later, turned it into the key scene in Citizen Kane, where Charles Foster Kane's, untalented opera singer wife bombs on stage. And so it became fictionalized in Citizen Kane, but it all started here in Chicago.
I love it. Jacob, there's a period around the turn of the century where I think this was also seen as an artist space in many ways. And I'm coming to you because of both the past and a current situation, because at some point, people began to leave that artist space. They came up north to the Treehouse, other places where artists would go. But my understanding now is if I walk the halls, maybe if I go visit Kieran and pass by his office, I might just hear the sound of violins or pianos or people taking lessons and rehearsing.
Yeah, the Fine Arts Building is very much alive, which is really an exciting thing to experience and absorb. If you come to the building any day of the week, you will hear music. If you're here on the weekends, the Chicago Youth Symphony Orchestra rings through the halls, and they are some of Chicago's most talented young musicians. It's really quite remarkable. There's no shortage of music teachers and music labs, and also instrument makers and repair shops. So there's always music playing through the halls on any given day on any given floor. And it's kind of incredible to be in a space, in a creative space like that, where you're also in a way sort of passively observing people refining their craft and really working on theirs. Because the work that Keir does in his studio is more of a quiet practice compared to the trumpet players down the hall that are, you know, tuning their horns during the day.
Yeah.
I don't know, Paul, if you can hear, there's a voice lesson going on right next door to me as we speak. And all morning there's been a tuba player down the hall. So yes, it's very alive in the halls.
If you need to register a complaint, Jacob is right here in the interview. So no, I imagine that's part of the charm, right? I imagine you enjoy that.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things I love too is that, well, we do hear world-class musicians. I mean, there are sopranos, you know, echoing up the courtyard that, you know, are lyric worthy, if not actual lyric performers. But I also love sometimes that we hear amateurs and we hear beginners, because it's just it's an important reminder that this is not just for professionals. This is for learners. And this is for, you know, I mean, I often lament the decline of amateurism in culture, because I think there's this, you know, we've kind of developed the sense that everybody has to be an expert or something, but we should also just feel free to explore and try and take lessons. And so I honestly love hearing the learners here too.
Yeah, I have a great little story that I want to share really quick about that, which is recently I encountered a really interesting violin playing in the hallway, and it was not so great. And as I turned the hall, I saw this very small child playing this very small violin, and I met this child and his mom, who told me that her mom was in the Chicago Youth Symphony Orchestra. She was in the Chicago Youth Symphony Orchestra, and she brought her 8-year-old son to the Fine Arts Building to get his first child's violin so that he could start practicing and also become part of the Youth Symphony Orchestra. So there's, even in that sort of not so great playing of the violin, there's this magical thread that's being pulled.
Did the kids say, how do I get to Studebaker Hall? And you said, practice, practice, practice.
That's right. That's right.
Works for Carnegie. It can work here.
That's right.
Keir, when you think back to the theaters, this was sort of interesting too. I thought about this in terms of its location, but back around the turn of the century, and what I have in my mind is the fire of in the Iroquois Theater in 1906, where many people died and all of that. But that affected the life of theaters in the downtown area, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm sure Jacob could speak to this more eloquently or informedly than me. But I do know that when you look at these early photographs of the Studebaker, there are a lot more people packed in there. The seating capacity was treated very differently. And now it's what, 600 seats, Jacob?
600 now. When it first opened, it was over 1,500.
Really? Same space?
Yeah, it was designed a little differently. The architecture in the room now is from a 1917 renovation that the Schubert Organization did when they took it over as a touring house. So slightly different configuration, but the same square footage, certainly.
But it's about safety. It's not about the fact that we're eating more Twinkies now or anything like that?
I think it's a combination of both.
Could be.
I think they grew them a lot smaller in 1898, you know?
Nutrition wasn't what it was, what it is now.
Yeah.
Kieran, your research, I want to go back to the movie theaters just for a second because I worked for M&R and so it's of interest to me. But the reason those didn't work, and I remember going down there and seeing that they were horrible spaces for movies. I mean, they're just horrible down there. But they didn't close because the movies were horrible, I don't think. Wasn't it because eventually M&R got bought out by Lowe's, and I think I left them when Sony bought Lowe's. It was really kind of the corporate conglomerate thing that was destroying the potential of those things, or was it the fact that they were horrible movie theaters?
Well, I understand. I think it might be a combination of the two, because the theaters were terrible. I remember several times, the first few times I came, you'd follow these little passageways and to these cramped little theaters, and which I now understand were the backstage spaces. I didn't understand how they were laid out at the time, because I hadn't been to the building before. And then one time I came to see a movie, and it was actually in the Studebaker. It was Theater One. I thought, oh my gosh, why are they hiding this place? And, you know, of course, I was one of six people for whatever movie that was. But as I understand it, one of the key things is that when they were sold, their new owner then opened Piper's Alley, which was also programmed to show the kind of same art house stuff and, you know, first run cool movies. And so suddenly you've got a brand new theater, air conditioning works better, you know, the carpets aren't sticky. And all of a sudden, you know, the fine arts theaters looked like kind of yesterday's news.
Yeah.
So I think that was a factor.
Jacob, the clubs that were in there, like the Cliff Dwellers, I actually did a program at the Midwestern authors do their events at the Cliff Dwellers, and I emceed one of them once. It's not there anymore, right? I was somewhere else when I did that, right?
Yeah, the Cliff Dwellers haven't been here in quite some time.
Yeah, and the time they were with you, it was an all male club, I believe. So was it? Did you have any
right.
history? Either of you have any history about sort of like the clubs and how those developed and where do things stand now? Are there any of those kinds of facilities in the building?
We don't, well, we unofficially refer to Exile in Bookville as the new little room, or as I like to call it, the clubhouse. It is a fun gathering space, and that bookstore and the owners, Javier and Kristen, are really incredible about intentionally building community in that place. And there's always really cool events going on in there. So we unofficially call it the new arts club of the fine arts building. But, you know, yeah, you're talking about the Little Room and the Caxton Club and the Cliff Dwellers. And, you know, the Caxton Club was a literary club, a book club, if you will, at the turn of the century in the fine arts building on the 10th floor, right down the hall from the illustrator William Denslow, which is where he met author L. Frank Baum and how they began to develop The Wonderful Wizard of Oz together. So there's those kind of magical stories that come from those clubs back then.
And some great
There's
parties.
A fun story related to that, too, which is that Nellie Walker, after the Cliff Dwellers scorned women members, she formed the Cordon Club in the Fine Arts Building in 1915. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in fact, yes, and I had a note about that too. I also wanted to mention Tommy Durkin's great parties. Don't you wish you were around for his St. Patrick's and Christmas parties?
Yeah, they're legendary.
And now there's a Durkin Hall, right?
The lobby is named for Tommy Durkin. It's now known as Durkin Hall. And I actually recently have been corresponding with Tommy Durkin's great niece. And she told me she's the only member of the family that has gone to Notre Dame and continued that legacy. But she even remembers coming here as a really young person and coming to those parties.
Although I think, you know, in the book, Akir, he died in 2013. He didn't die all that long ago, Tommy Durkin.
No.
Correct. And I think he had been working he worked full time from, I want to say, 1950 to 2000.
Yeah.
Took a brief retirement, was coaxed back into working part time because people missed him so much. I so wish that I could have attended those parties. And as I say in the book, one of the things that I think, you know, when the building was founded in 1898 as the Fine Arts Building, you know, it was really high toned and elegant and wanted to emulate, you know, European sophistication, and did. But I think that in the Tommy Durkin years, it's when it came into its own as a Chicago institution, a little more egalitarian, because here you have an elevator operator, an uneducated immigrant to the United States who became a really central figure to the social life of the building and would throw parties that, you know, all the artists and even the owner would rearrange their schedules to attend.
We have to talk about murder. You know, Kira's, I kept sort of saying we're going to get to the murder. And in the subtitle of the book, Music, Magic, and Murder, who died? Who got killed? What happened?
So Everett Clark was a radio actor in the kind of golden age of radio and had a number of minor hits. He was in a local version of The Whistler, which was a national hit, and then Chicago did a version, and he was the star of that. He had a wide list of shows he did, including something called The Space Adventures of Super Noodle. But apparently, you know, I don't know if he had a face for radio or what, but when TV came in the 1950s, he suddenly was not working as much. And so he became a drama teacher, and he took a studio on the 10th floor of the Fine Arts Building and taught for many years and was very beloved until one day in 1980, he did not come home. And his concerned partner called the painter who had the studio next door. And she knocked on the door and tried the door handle. No answer, and the door was locked. She got either an engineer or an elevator operator to open the studio. And when they opened the door, they were pushed aside all these notes from students whose appointments he had missed. And there he was lying on the stage. There was a practice stage in his studio. And he had been stabbed to death with a pair of scissors. Very gruesome, gruesome crime. And the painter recalled that she had heard him cry out during the afternoon, "No, Paul, no, God, no.
It wasn't me."
I think you're in the clear.
Okay.
And, you know, so she had heard him being murdered, but because he so often acted out scenes with students, how would she have possibly known? And so, you know, in the book, I detail the story of how they found which Paul wielded the scissors and how they tracked him down. And his escape from the crime scene, from this locked room, was worthy of a movie.
And Jacob, now I have to ask the critical question. Is the ghost, are there ghosts in the building, whether they're left over from this or something else? You know, when Rich Regan over at the Auditorium Theater, he talks about the fact that people have all these stories where you're in the lay and there's somebody sitting there, mm-hmm. and then they're not sitting there, and they're got a top. There have to be ghosts in the Studebaker. You've been around so long, and it could be Paul or his buddy here.
I will tell you that I have not personally had an experience, but I have heard lots of fantastic stories about people having experiences in the building. Some of them, the stories are so wholly unbelievable that it's eerie.
So unbelievable that they're believable?
Yeah. Like there's an actual great one that I heard. My favorite one is we had a show here, and one of the actors in the show said they had encountered a ghost whose name was Margie, who was a secretary in the building. And I was like, oh, ha, 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 you know, kind of laughed it off. I didn't really take it too seriously. I thought he was joking. And he was like, no, this really happened to me. You know, the dressing room got cold, da, 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 all these things. He tells me this whole story. So fast forward several months later, and I'm in my research, you know, going through archives, and I find this article from the Chicago Sun-Times detailing a character by the name of Marjorie who legendarily came with the building, and she was the assistant to Tom Graham, the owner, and to the owner before Tom. And the story is that she, you know, passed away, and she was the one who would come collect all the rent checks. And a tenant asked someone on the management team, oh, you know, how's Margie? I haven't seen her. And then she said, oh, you know, she passed away a few months ago. And the tenant said, wait, that doesn't make any sense, because I saw her in the stairwell 3 weeks ago.
Collecting checks.
So there you go. Collecting
the
checks.
She wasn't dead. She had a scam kite. Check chiting thing going on. Is
that's right. You've seen Catch Me If You Can.
Yes. And it's coming back, by the way, to the Marriott.
That's right.
Keir, you know, when I first So a former partner of mine is in architecture, and you know, so I'm just into the architecture of the city and all of that, and the tours and all that sort of thing. And so when I first saw this book come out, I thought, well, it's all about the beauty of the Chicago Fine Arts Building, and it is. But then there's these stories. So I'm so curious, as a writer, were you initially intrigued? Was it about, yes, this is a magnificent building, and we have to talk about the structure and the various lovely things in the building? Or was it the history that we hear about and that you write about in this book? What grabbed you, one over the other or equal? What grabbed you?
Well, there's not a ton about the architecture in this building. And I think it's primarily because I am a storyteller. You know, I write fiction. As you say, I've published 14 novels. I write books for adults and for kids. I co-write with kids books with James Patterson. I co-write adult novels. I have to say, not my wife, a woman named Linda Jaffe Hull, who's my writing partner, but not my life partner. We write as Linda Keir.
Well, that's why I made the assumption, because of that. Okay.
It's a common error. But so I was drawn to the stories of the building and the stories of the people in the building, you know, and I'm not a historian. You know, I always have to kind of preface things by saying I'm not a historian. I loved studying the history of this building, but what grabbed me was the human aspect of it. My wife is actually an architect, and I appreciate architecture, and I love Chicago's rich architecture, but I don't think that my strength would be writing, you know, about the design of the building. And so while I touch on that, and I actually saw one guy put my book down in a bookstore the other day and said there wasn't enough architecture, there wasn't enough Solon S. Beeman in it, which is fine, it's fair. My real goal in writing this was to provide an introduction to the building, you know, a long view, and to encourage people to come to the building and explore it for themselves and explore the stories that intrigue them, and hopefully to become patrons of the arts themselves, you know, because the artists who work here can't make it without patrons. And whether that's buying a ticket to a show in the Studebaker or subscribing to, you know, somebody's newsletter or buying a painting from one of the many painters here, or just being an audience, being an appreciator. That's kind of my subversive goal in writing the book, is that I hope more people will become patrons of the arts, and particularly the artists in this building.
Well, and I've become a huge fan of the building over the last period of years. And, you know, and actually what you said here makes perfect sense for me, in that when I first saw the book, I thought it was an architecture book. I mean, it makes sense that it would be. And then I started to read it. And that's when I went to your bio. I went, what, that's not what's going on here. Right. And you get this beautiful story of the book. Jacob, for people that have watched us or listened to this and are intrigued by this, my guess is they can come to the Fine Arts Building and perhaps get a tour one way or the other. Is this on the Chicago Docents, Chicago Architectural Docents tour? How do people find out? Yeah, talk about how they both see the building and how beautiful it is, but maybe get some of Keir's stories.
Yeah, so there's a whole host of ways that are available to you. The easiest access point is just come to the Fine Arts Building. It's open 7 days a week. It's open to the public. I always recommend taking the elevators up to the 10th floor, and if you are able, walk down the stairs and work your way down. We have installed plaques all over the building commemorating historic tenants and also current tenants that we would refer to as legacy tenants, folks that have been here for 20, 30, 40, 50 years that have really contributed significantly to the story and history of the Fine Arts Building.
Does Keir have a plaque?
Not yet.
Not yet.
I'm just checking. Sorry, go ahead.
Coming soon. Also, the Chicago Architecture Center does do tours of the Fine Arts Building, and we have information about that on our website, and you can also go to the Chicago Architecture Center's website about it. Also, another Fine Arts Building tenant, Ronnie Frey, who runs the Doorways of Chicago Instagram account, which is a much beloved account of architecture photography here in Chicago. He also gives tours of the Fine Arts Building, and you can find information about that at his Instagram account of Doorways at Chicago.
Which is just fabulous. But I love when I talk to people who perform there, like Liz Calloway recently and others. They love performing in that space, not just because of the history, though that's part of it, I suppose, but the acoustics are amazing in that space. There's no bad seat in the space. Maybe it's good that you don't have the 1,500 seats. I mean, the truth is, wherever you sit, you're getting a great view. And I just always feel, I remember why I saw Porchlight Music Theater Sunday in the Park with George. And it's just an experience, with all due respect to the other wonderful theaters in town. It's got its own experience when you're sitting in that space and really taking it in.
Well, when we did the renovation of the Studebaker, you know, and I walked in and saw the magnificent architecture in the room, the goal was to bring a contemporary standard of making theater and making live events and shows into this vintage jewel box, right? And you sit, my goal is that you walk into a little bit of a time capsule. You step back in time when you're in this room, because they don't make them like this anymore. The amount of care and artistry that was put into the architecture details of this room is unparalleled. And a lot of the theaters from this era don't exist anymore. Have been turned into hotels and other such things. So, you know, you get that at a lot of the Broadway and Chicago theaters too. When you walk into, you know, the Cadillac Palace or the Nederlander Theater, and you know, the architecture is undeniable. Beautiful. Yeah.
But it's a special experience at the Studebaker. Well, congratulations, and I guess that goes to Keir. I have to be careful here in my background, but this is such a wonderful and beautiful and well done book. Congratulations on the story. And as I said, it was a pleasant surprise to see that I wasn't getting the, and then they put the screw in the knot. We're getting the story and the history of the building in such a beautiful way. And of course, when I decided to do it, Jacob, I had to invite you to join this conversation because all you do. So you can get this book anywhere. They sell fine books and probably in the Fine Arts Building, right?
Exile in Bookville on the second floor. It's just a gorgeous bookstore that people should visit for just to browse. But certainly if they want to get a copy of this book, they almost always have signed copies. It's right at the front register.
Or if not, we just go outside your eighth floor office and wait for you to show up and have you sign it there.
That's right.
Which I'm going to do one day.
That could happen.
Anyway, thank you both for joining me. And I encourage everybody to check out the Fine Arts Building and the Studebaker Theater. I just, like, every time I have something coming up there, I'm coming there soon, by the way. You're doing a preview of 44, the Obama musical. So I will be
there. See you next week.
Yeah, I will see you for that. So congratulations on this. It's a fantastic book. I encourage everybody to check it out. And for all the WGNRadio.com, what are we? WGNRadio.com watchers and listeners, thanks for listening to this extra conversation. We'll see you next week on Paul Lisnick Behind the Curtain.